This is Mental Selling. This is the sales podcast for people that are dedicated to making a difference in customers' lives and have a purpose beyond just a paycheck. I'm your host, Will Milano. Let's get right into the show. Do you have to choose between making money and making a difference? Better understanding your purpose and leveraging it will drive stronger results. It also helps you grow a loyal customer base, establish your competitive differentiation, and attract and retain top talent. Welcome back to Mental Selling, your favorite sales podcast. Lisa Earl McLeod is best-selling author of the books Selling Noble Purpose and Leading with Noble Purpose. She's a highly sought-after keynote speaker, consultant, and executive coach, and she's a regular contributor to publications like Harvard Business Review and Forbes. Lisa was also my guest back on our episode 31, and if you've never listened to that one, please go back later and hear it, as it's one of my favorites that we've done on the show. It's my pleasure to welcome back Lisa to the show today. Thanks very much for talking with me today, Lisa.
It's great to be back with you, Will.
I wanted to start with something. You've written so much about purpose and the direct links between purpose and sales success. What are some of the things that, from your standpoint, people get wrong about understanding what purpose is and why it's important?
Words only mean what we think they mean. And in the 15 years I've been doing this, purpose has become part of the corporate vernacular. In my opinion, people get a lot of things wrong. So I'm going to start with a fact. Salespeople who have a purpose bigger than money, who truly want to improve life for customers, outsell salespeople who are just focused on the transaction and closing the deal. So we know that for a fact. Second fact, companies with a purpose bigger than money outperform the market because they're more customer focused, they attract better talent. But here's what people get wrong about the purpose conversation. They think it's about ESG metrics or some vague do-gooder things. ESG metrics matter. Being a good corporate citizen matters. But your purpose as an organization is to improve life for customers. Full stop. And I want to draw a line here because Milton Friedman, God rest his cold-hearted soul, is the one that told us in the 1990s that the purpose of a corporation was to deliver a return to shareholders. And so when I'm saying the purpose of a company is to improve life for customers, what we know is that if you do that, revenue and shareholder price are a lagging indicator and they will follow. So I'm not saying go away with that. And that's one of the mistakes people make. They often think saying, well, improve life for customers, do I have to give everything away? No. The most valuable companies on the planet are those that do the best job of improving life for customers.
Revenue in just about every way is a lagging indicator. And that focus, whether it's as an organizational sales culture or individually as a salesperson, that's where the primary or tip of the spear should be.
Well, and you bring up the point of as the individual salesperson or as the organization, both of those, the same concept applies. When I am an organization, you know, you and I have a lot of the same colleagues in common. I work with a lot of CEOs and chief commercial officers, VPs of sales. When they stand up and say, our purpose is to improve life for customers, we improve the customer's life in this way, and all of you need to go out and find more customers whose lives we can improve and ask them questions about how we can improve it and deliver a value. That's happening at the top of the organization. Funnel that all the way down to the sales, to use your concept, mental selling, funnel that all the way down to what mindset am I showing up with? And we've all had that seller who shows up with the, I want to close it, I want to close it, I want to close it. And that was 10 years ago, annoying. Now, they're hobbled forever if they show up with that mindset. And so the problem is, we say at the top of the organization, we want to improve life for customers. But so often, the voice in the seller's ear is, close it today. And that then translates. The internal conversation becomes the external conversation, and that translates into sales behavior. But if we can tell our sellers, you're here to figure out how to improve life for customers, then what follows is all those great sales behaviors that we want them to exhibit, deep discovery, better listening, all those things, because their end game is improve life for the customer.
And part of what the organization has a responsibility for doing is helping articulate what that looks like. So it's not just a concept, because otherwise the knee-jerk can be going back to just the sort of the going through the motions with the customers, which customer, we've talked a lot on this podcast before about this, like customers pick up on it one way or the other, whether they realize if you're there to help improve them and their lives and make a difference for them, or if you're just there to check a box and close the deal. You can't fake it.
And they can feel it. And I'm using that word feel very intentionally. There's not a moment in their mind when they go, are they here to help me or are they here to close me? That moment occurs over time. And when I say over time, over the 5 minutes that you're talking to them or over a series of sales calls, but they're putting you in one of those camps or the other. And that was really obvious during COVID. And it's once you know something, you can't unknow it. And so customers got super wise to it during COVID. They were all stressed. They were asking that question, are you here to help me? Or are you just here to close me? On Zoom, it became more obvious what your motives were because you didn't have all the little niceties of shaking hands and getting a cup of coffee. And now that customers know that, they can't unknow it. And so what happens is, to your point, leadership has a fundamental responsibility to say, here is how we strive to improve life for our customers. And this goes beyond just the generic value prop. We hope we'll be more efficient. You got to get better than that. But it's about telling stories about how we improve their life. It's about giving examples. It's about articulating the ripple effect. When we help them get more efficient, this is what happens to their jobs. And then leadership says, your job is to figure out how to do that for your customer. Because too often we say, yeah, customer, do deep discovery, listen well, understand their goals and challenges. But we say it conceptually. When the feet hit the ground, we say, "What are you going to close this deal? How much is it going to be?" Very valid question, but it matters. But if you think you're going to drive good sales behavior by saying, close it faster and close it bigger, you are very wrong.
So then along those lines, the next thing I wanted to get into is this idea of purpose. Also means having the clarity, which I think you're referring to, and the discipline to play the long game. That's especially applicable in sales, to your point you just made, because it takes, you've got to go beyond, I've got to close this deal right now. And if you're there to do right by the customer, it means taking the time to make sure that happens.
So I'll tell you a deeper dive into our research. Salespeople who have this thing we call noble purpose, to improve life for customers, sell higher margin deals, and they sell stickier deals. And the reason is that they did take the time to understand what were the customer's larger business objectives. They did take the time to figure out who all the other players are inside the customer that are going to be affected by this. And when you talk about the short term versus the long term, this is a challenge for humans. Do I eat the donut or do I go exercise? This is a challenge for organizations, but nowhere is this more challenge more present in business than in sales. And I want to preface this by saying, if you are selling something that is a simple transaction, that is a low ticket item, that is a one call close, that's a very valid business model. There is nothing wrong with doing that. And the more you lean in that one 10 minute conversation to understand your customer quickly, the more successful you'll be. Having said that, most B2B sellers are selling something that has a longer sales cycle, that takes more time, that has higher stake. And they're not necessarily more people that can say yes, but there are plenty that can say no or delay it. Because of that, if you come at this with this short-term close-it energy, one, you're off putting to the customer, but two, you're going to miss shit. You're going to miss all kinds of stuff because, and every sales manager alive, I used to be a VP of sales and I've coached a lot of salespeople. And there's a moment in the sales call where the customer says, yeah, we have a bit of a challenge with XYZ. And the little bell goes off in the seller's head. And they've got a choice at that moment. They can take the choice of most sellers where they go, oh, we can help you with that. What can I do? What can I do? Or they can go, tell me a little bit more. What's that costing you? They just have the patience. And as you said, play a longer game and say, tell me a little bit more. What's that costing you? What's the win for you to get that fixed? What's the long-term implication of not getting it fixed? All of a sudden, we are having a very different conversation. And I'm not pitching, I'm collaborating.
One of the important questions there to ask is very typical. What's the cost of doing nothing? Because so often, that's what the customer's knee-jerk is going to be. It's like, no, I'll just let it go. They're going to do nothing.
If they look at you and say, the cost of doing nothing, let me think this through, A, B, C, very minimal. Better we know that now than I go through all the gymnastics of a proposal. And then you go, it's really not worth it to us to fix this problem. nine times out of 10, they haven't thought through the costs and they are significant. And that's part of the job of the seller. I do want to make a point. One of the things we found in our research was, and there's some new research from Dr. Valerie Good at Michigan State University about this that validates what we saw in some of our anecdotal research, which was even in organizations where the message from the top is close it, the highest performing salespeople in those organizations have a different internal talk track. They run on that dual path of their urgency is close it because it helps the customer. And so their urgency is around how can I help the customer? And they still, even in these super transactional organizations, they are selling at a higher margin their deal stick.
We're saying before, ideally, you want the entire sales organization and culture of the organization to be supportive of this. But if they're not, you as an individual seller still can and should take that upon yourself, and you're going to be better. You'll stand out.
And it's interesting because when we ask people, tell us about your top sellers, they'll say, oh, so-and-so, she's our number one sales rep. She's really money motivated. Oh, I want to interview her. And she'll say, yeah, I care a lot about money. And then I'll say, tell me about how you help customers. And inevitably, there's the whole story. There's the, we do this for them. And the enthusiasm goes up. And it's this false dichotomy that we create. And the best salespeople are ambitious financially. And they're leading their driver when they're in their sales calls is how can I help life for this customer? And what we found is there's a group of people that this is innate for. And they'll be the top performers everywhere. And if the organization gets too transactional, they'll leave and go somewhere else. But the middle of the bell curve, the majority of people can behave that way, but they need the leadership reinforcement because it is not innate to them. They're just showing up trying to do a good job. And if the boss says, you need to close this, they go, okay, you know, I want to do a good job. They're not bad people. But the leadership narrative and voice and coaching, that's what really influences that middle group, which, by the way, is 75% of people.
In your work, what is it that you see most successful salespeople do differently?
Specificity. We have a saying in our business, specificity is sexy. The most successful sellers do all the things that the average sellers do. They know their product, they know their territory, they know their customers, blah, 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 blah. But they have a depth of knowledge. And so I want to talk about two things. One, their driver, their satisfaction, their sense of purpose comes from improving life for customers. So that is the emotional undercurrent of everything they do. In tandem with that, because of that and further fueling that, so it's like a what Jim Collins would refer to as a flywheel, is the depth of understanding. So they understand a couple things. When you ask average salespeople, what are your customers' biggest challenges? They will give them through the lens of their own product. They will answer things like, well, our customers need their accounting systems to be more efficient if you sell accounting software. When you ask top sellers, what are your customers' biggest challenges? They will give it to you in the language of the customer. They will say, our customers are trying to minimize downtime because every day in the field for them represents this much money, whatever it is. They have a specificity of understanding the customer's issues in a deep and meaningful way. The other thing they have specificity is how their solution has what we call a ripple effect. And this can be taught. We've taught it to lots of salespeople, but the top performers know it. They say, we help them with their accounting system. But where that ripples out is it saves them time. They don't get calls from other people inside the organization. And when they don't get those calls, their own personal reputation is better. They go home feeling better. Like they have clarity about that. And so I'm going to go one more on the specificity. They understand that from a general customer base, the specificity of the challenge and the specificity of how their solution impacts it. And then they understand it from each customer's perspective. If I was a pediatrician and I knew tons about the first 3 months of a baby's life and I knew exactly what they're supposed to be doing and how they're doing it, I knew all the variables, and then I came to meet with you and your baby, I would ask questions to see where your baby is in this spectrum. But it's based on my very deep knowledge versus the person that goes, hey, you got a baby. When do they walk and talk? What's the deal with that?
Because you're flipping it around to convey and your expertise in such a different and more personalized, relevant way, not from the angle of our products, we do this, we, I'm our, that sort of thing. It's all from the angle of you.
It's the difference between the seller, who may be perfectly good seller, and they might hit their quota. They're probably not going to exceed it. But the seller who goes in and says, we've got accounting software that can save you a lot of time. Can we talk about what kind of time you're currently spending? Not bad. But that noble purpose seller goes in and says, a lot of the work we've done with firms has revealed that partners in your situation are spending about 20% of their time on non-value work. What's been your experience with that? Different as night and day. So I'm asking them questions. I'm not telling them my expertise, but I'm asking them questions. Like when I work with a VP of sales, I've done my homework beforehand. And I don't go, so what do you guys sell? So what are your biggest challenges? What keeps you up at night? I say, I've been looking online. It looks like you're number three in the market. And if I were to hazard a guess, a lot of your deals are probably coming down to price. Is that the case?
You're conveying it in a way that establishes your credibility just so much more.
And I care, too. I'm not coming in going, hey, I'm saying I really spent some time. I did some homework. Based on my knowledge, I think this is probably one or two of the challenges. What's your take on this? You ask, what is the thing that the top sellers do differently? They have a different emotional driver, this sense of purpose. And then because of that, and further fueling that, is the specificity with which they approach everything. Specificity is sexy.
Sales teams, they will tend to respond, of course, to what is measured from the top. And those metrics, they're hopefully motivating versus demoralizing for the sales team. We know that things like revenue and win rates, revenue is a lagging indicator. It's what's happened in the past. It's yesterday's story. What are some measures that you think better reflect like real-time current performance? They're more leading indicators of what's to come.
And so let's be clear. Revenue and margin matters. Stock price matters. That is the lagging indicator. It's just like test scores in a school. They're a lagging indicator. Sales management needs to go further upstream. So some examples, I'll give you some qualitative examples and also some quantitative ones. And the reason that we tend to look at those cut and dried metrics, number of deals closed, margin on the deal, things like that, are because they're easy to measure. We see them. They go on a spreadsheet. But they are not the heartbeat of the organization. They are the impact of the words, the beliefs, and the behaviors of your sales team. So what we want to start measuring more is the words, beliefs, and behaviors of your sales team. So an example, I'll give you one thing, and this is a coaching technique and a measurement technique, is when a rep is in process with a deal or a rep closes a deal, ask them, how is the customer different as a result of this work? Your sellers, if I have a team of 25 sellers and I say, let's look at the last deal you closed, or let's look at the biggest deal you've got in play. And I say, how is the customer different, or how will the customer be different if it's a deal in play? If I ask that of 25 sellers and I do not get a good answer from 22 of them, I can tell you right now, you're going to have a margin problem in about 12 months. That is an indicator. It is not a cut and dried flat measurement, but how well can your sellers articulate the impact, not the generic value prop, but the impact for the customer on the deals they're selling and the deals they have in play. That's a measurement. That is a measurement. Some more cut and dried measurements are the customer referrals you're getting. How many customer referrals are you getting? And when somebody leaves a customer to go to another customer, do they call you? These are more measurable and trackable. Having said that, there was a great piece in the HBR a couple of years ago called Are Your Metrics Eroding Your Business? And it was talking about a thing they call strategy surrogation. And strategy surrogation is when the measurement of the strategy becomes the strategy. An example they used was Wells Fargo. We want to get more business with our existing customers. We want to have a more holistic relationship with them. We want them talking to us about their larger problems. Oh, how are we going to measure this? How many accounts they have with us? Then we stopped talking about the win for the customer. We just doubled down on the metric. And so the reason I say referrals, if I just measure my salespeople on referrals and that's all we talk about all day, I'm missing the point. I've done the strategy surrogation. So when you talk about what you can measure, things you can measure are how well people are able to answer what we call the game-changing question. How will the customer be different? How many referrals? Not making it the thing you're beating people about the head on. Another thing you can measure that is a leading indicator is the amount of customer intelligence your salespeople have. Go in your CRM and look and see if there's anything about customer goals, customer challenges, what does success look like for the customer in whatever CRM you use to take notes. That's an indicator. And they'll also affect the handoff, because even if you close the deal, if you don't know those things, the implementation is not going to be great. Your implementation team is going to struggle. And so those are examples. What we've seen with our clients be really successful in terms of getting a handle on measuring, we're still going to talk about the revenue and profit, but let's also talk about how many lives our solution affected. That gets me thinking differently. I've got some software, we're just in the medical company, and they switch from dollars when they presented their meeting. Because let's be honest, the average Joe doesn't control margin. Do the dollars really matter to them? Now the CEO stands up and says, I'm going to do dollars and cents to my board, but to you all, it's number of patients. That's the metric. We're on number of lives changed. That's our metric. That's what we talk about every day. And then what they say is a way that we'll know we're working towards success is all of our managers are going to ask, how will this customer be different? And we're going to rate ourselves on how well we can answer that question. We're all going to be looking in the CRM to say, how much of the customer's goals and challenges have we actually captured so that it's shared information for the implementation team? Those are some of the leading things. But as we talked about it, some of the managers listening to this are probably going,
but that's part of the coaching culture that they have to be putting in place. It's asking those types of questions. It's not asking the revenue and pipeline and let's look at the spreadsheet sort of questions.
They matter, but they will not drive the sales behavior you want. That's why we call it, if you're doing a deal review and you do, when are you going to close it? How much is it going to be? Who's the competition? Who are the decision makers? That is sales management 101. Ask all those questions. Add one more question. How will the customer be different as a result of this deal? That question will drive an entirely different set of sales behaviors. And if I've got a rep, let's just say I'm coaching you and you're about to go in to close the biggest deal of your life, and I ask you that question and you go, I don't know. We got a big problem because your story for the customer is going to be terrible because you don't know.
Just as a quick aside, and I didn't have this on the list I wanted to ask you, but you brought up referrals, and I just want to probe a little bit because we actually have another episode coming up that's all about referrals, because referrals are a good leading indicator. Referrals mean that you're getting into more new conversations, so that's a good leading indicator. To what degree do you see salespeople needing to make sure they're asking them versus sitting back and waiting and hoping they're getting them?
They don't ask enough, and I'll be curious to see what your podcast about this says, but in my experience, they don't ask enough. And the reason they don't ask enough is because they think they're asking the client to do them a favor and they ask wrong. One of the things that we teach, and especially on bigger things, when you are closing a big thing and you're in implementation, is to say, I feel like the work we've done together here has been really great. What's your take on that? Make sure they say, I agree. If they say, no, there's problems, that this conversation is going a different way, but I agree, it's great. It would really be helpful to me if you could think of some other people who might benefit from this. And I'd love to call on them. Just think about it. And next time I come back, I'll ask you, is that okay? They're not on the spot. They're not anything. And you notice the language. I'd really appreciate you if you could connect me with a bunch of your colleagues. Then if I'm the customer, maybe I'm like that super generous, great customer. And I go, great, I'd love to. But I'm still thinking about you, the seller. But if I ask the question to say, think about who else might find this helpful. You might know somebody who might find this helpful. Then I'm thinking, who would find this helpful? So I'm going to give you a better referral and I'm going to tee it up in a better way. And one of the things someone asked me something years ago is a young man that I connected to a VP of sales who ended up getting the job. And he said, oh, I can't thank you enough. You've done me such a big favor. And I said, who I did the favor for? The VP of sales. And that's what you want that be. I said, I appreciate you thanking me, but let me promise you, he's the one that owes me a lunch, not you, because I just gave him a great guy. You know? And that's how you want your customers feeling. And you set that seed in the way that you ask.
Something else that I wanted to ask you about, and you wrote about this for HBR last year, is around win-loss analysis. And it's something that sales teams know that they should spend more time on, but that sort of stuff can get tossed aside pretty quickly when other priorities arise. And especially in the case of lost deals, sometimes the salesperson, either consciously or subconsciously, they don't want to revisit it. But you say that unpacking wins and losses provides some really valuable insights, and that you wrote in the piece, there are three questions that a team should ask. I was wondering if you might talk about those.
When we win a deal, yay, we're amazing, we're awesome, I've already spent the commission, this is great. When we lose a deal, oh, the competition undercut us, those people don't know what they're doing. Like, those were the two reactions. Having said that, there are three questions. They don't take forever. And there was this HBR piece that I wrote with a buddy of mine about sales retrospectives. And they can be used whether we won or lost a deal. So if you insert them into your weekly meeting over the best deals, they take the sting away from the loss, and they create shared learning for the win or the loss. So the first one is, how would the customer articulate the value of their choice? So we won this deal, we're in the sales meeting, congratulations, Will is the sales god amongst men. Tell us, how would the customer articulate the value of the choice? That helps the whole team see this is why people buy. Because usually if it's a one deal, we're lauding you. And if it's a lost deal, you feel ashamed. Neither of those are particularly helpful for future learning. So how would the customer articulate the value of their choice? Who was the most influential voice in and out of the room? Because it was talked earlier. It is a big one. We've all had that deal we thought we were going to get. And I never forget it after I learn it, especially if I'm the one that lost the deal. One of the things, the examples we put in the HBR piece was there was a fintech firm. And when they looked more closely at the decision makers, it became obvious that the CIO was making the final call almost every time. And the CIO didn't want to meet with a seller. But now we know next time we're not just going to give token things, but the CIO had a feature list that was the go or no go list. So your answer might be different, but once I know I'm going to need the support of this person, now we know, find ways to get that person in a loop. And then the last one, this is really important, beyond price, what were the key deciding factors in the client's decision? Because most salespeople, when they lose a deal, will say it's price. Often the client will say it's price because that's the easiest thing to say. But really going through, and the answer might be, I don't know. Then it becomes, let's see if we can find out. And again, these questions, whether you won it or lost it, they are going to get you to that thing that you asked me, what differentiates the top sellers, that level of specificity of understanding those three things, the value of the choice from the customer's perspective, who were the influencers in and out of the room, and beyond price, what do people care about?
Yeah, it's going to feed into those things that we talked about before that you've got to be clear about future deals.
And so if we're having that group conversation, now we're not just lauding the winner who won the deal. That's great. But now we all know what tends to happen when somebody wins a deal is we say, what did you do? What did you do? Show us your deck because I want everybody to be as good as you. That's usually not where the learning is. The learning is around unpacking the client's decision process. And if somebody lost a deal, we're so ashamed. I felt that. It's terrible. And then the whole group knows. And now we've detached the personal failure from it, looked at it from the client's point of view, and we're now all empowered. It's a very different way of doing it. When we were working on this piece, one of the things, and my buddy is Ian Gross, he's in role as a VP of sales. And one of the things we wanted to do was to give sales leaders something they could do on one deal a week in 10 minutes.
Right. But now it's a good idea. You can shine a spotlight just on one deal like that once a week, however often you meet.
Once a week. Like that's what we do. Let's look at a win. Let's look at a loss. And what you're doing is you're embedding it proactively in your sales team. And so it's an HBR piece. I'm sure people can find it. Three questions sales team should ask after losing or winning a deal.
Salespeople, they can feel really overwhelmed these days, and they're under pressure to say yes to just about anything, especially anything that might lead to more revenue. But you've said that there's a time and a place to say no to additional work. And I was wondering if you would talk about that and why salespeople should feel empowered and comfortable saying no sometimes.
The only way you would feel empowered to say no is if you have absolute clarity of how your solution makes a difference to the customer. The power to say no comes from competence. And so there's that old expression, the customer is always right. No, they're not. They're actually not. And it's your job to tell them when they're not. And when we talk about extra work, there's a lot of places that shows up for sellers. That is when they're doing a project and they see other things that could be added. They're selling soft services. And I can tell you, I've been guilty of this one, where I see, oh, we could also do this. And then I start doing it. What am I doing that for? And it came from me, not them. That's the worst. I'm guilty of that. But then there's other things that sellers often find themselves doing that put them in this subservient role to the client. For example, if I know that I need to go talk to a couple of other people before I come back to my buyer, there's a couple different ways I could approach that. The buyer should go, yeah, talk to them and find out what they know. And then I'm like the little minion that runs and does it. If I deem that something that's really important, I'll say, why don't we pick the two most important folks? Why don't I get their take, see what insights I can glean from that. And you and I huddle up and then see if there's other people maybe that you want to bring into the process. We've got a shared responsibility. What are the things I would ask you? What are the things you wanted to ask this question that you see sellers doing that you think they shouldn't be doing?
A lot of it, I think, can fall under the umbrella of administrative work, so that those demands can come internally versus from the customer. I think it's more that just the administrative stuff and things that fall under the roles of customer success could fall under marketing, operations, finance. They get involved in things like invoicing.
And the reason we do is because we don't want our stuff messed up. Because a lot of times I can't trust the other people. So I'll tell you about one group we worked with.
And it is a trust issue sometimes.
Yeah, you better believe I'm going to be involved in implementation. I can't trust those numbnuts. It's going to be terrible. One of the things that you can do if you're listening to this and you are the head of sales is one of the reasons why organizations have silos is not because people go off and go, I think I shall create a silo and not care about anyone else in the organization. And eventually I'll get so mired in my own metrics that I turn this into a turf war. Nobody wakes up and says that. The reason organizations have silos and you can't trust other people is because no one's put the holistic picture together for people. And they're just good people trying to hit what they think is important. One of the important roles that sales can play is to show customer impact. So we work with one organization and the chief commercial officer took the lead on this. We did executive briefings all around the organization where we had stories about how their solution made a difference to customers, how they implemented it, how the billing showed up. And so there's this idea of internal and external customers, and it's BS. There's one customer, the person who pays, and we all need to have a sight line to that. Show your colleagues respect, value other people's work, all those things. But once you start talking about, they're my internal customer, they're my, no, that just diminishes the urgency for real customers. And I want to be really clear. You don't have to be a handmaiden to your customer and do everything they ask you to. You don't have to be an indentured servant. But we all need to be clear on how our role contributes to the impact we're having on customers and be lined up around that.
Also, that idea of the quote-unquote internal customers creates an unintentional hierarchy, doesn't it? Versus a collaborative culture that you're all there equally in your area of expertise or functional role there to serve the customer.
And this idea to serve the customer, one of the nuances we talk about, because a lot of people, especially in a lot of service businesses, feel like indentured servants to the customers because the customers are so demanding, the customer could do her wrong. The more clarity you have about the impact, and the nuance here is pretty important because it doesn't show up nuanced in the results, is we're not just here to serve the customer. That's this whole customer-centric. Having a noble purpose is we're here to improve the customer. We want to give good customer service, but serve the customer says that anything's on the table. We're here to improve life for the customer, and we have some very clear ways that we're doing that. Then everyone can line up behind him. When we did it in this one organization and we drew a through line to how everyone was affecting the customer, it was in financial services. Then people who were really slow on getting paperwork done and things like that, it wasn't just I'm getting paperwork done for this guy in sales that makes more money than me. It's a real live human being that's waiting on this mortgage.
No, it is an important nuance that serving the customer connotates, at least to some extent, though, like if I say jump, you say how high. Improving the customer puts you more in the position of you're driving the bus. and leading them toward what's important to them. And so it's more of a side-by-side relationship and it's more collaborative. You're seen as more valuable because if you're serving the customers, aren't you commoditizing yourself a little bit?
You're very commoditized because anybody can do that. Because when you're serving the customers are puts out the RFP and who can be the cheapest. But when you're improving the customer, that's how you establish your differentiation. Because every sales organization I know has been in that spot, and I've been in it when I was a VP of sales, where we lost a piece of business because the customer said we chose so-and-so because they could do this and this. And we were like, we could have done that. That is the hardest piece of business to lose because what that says is 100% our fault on the sales end. Because we didn't showcase, we didn't get how important that was, and we didn't showcase our ability to do that. And that, back to this organizational alignment, the other thing that serving the customer, this we're all serving the customer does in creating that hierarchy is then when I'm sales and I go back and I say, well, customer wants it. We've all been that person. And they're like, oh, yeah, he comes back. He needs everything for his customers. But if we have alignment that we're improving the customer, then I can come back and say, this is what's at stake. If they don't get this system up and running, they're going to be out of business during their peak season. Oh, okay. Now we know who they is. We know about the customer. We understand that we're on board versus me being some demanding seller.
You're framing it around customer outcomes versus as a task to be delegated.
And I've already humanized the customer for everybody in the organization. This medical company that I just worked with, we did this session at their all-hands meeting. They have a once-a-year meeting where we brought in some customers. They talked about how their lives had been improved. We brought in some doctors. They talked about what it had done for their patients. And then the table of people that were accounting sat down and said, what role do you play in this? And they got really clear on how they were affecting people's health. They'll never forget that.
So lastly, I wanted to shift a bit toward sales leaders and get your perspective related to a lot of what we've already talked about. But how do you suggest that leaders help establish that clear line connecting individual jobs and organizational purpose? Are there strategies that can help maintain that connection?
I'll give you a couple of them. I'll preface this with saying, the sales leader is that spot in the middle where the numbers come down and hit you on the head like a ton of bricks. And going down, you have to drive behavior. We often say when we do sales management programs is you have to learn to be a filter, not a funnel, because all that stuff's coming down to you. And if you just dump it right down on your people, it will be bad. And so as a sales leader, you have to get your team to exhibit the mindset, skills, and behaviors that will deliver the number that someone is pushing down on you. And so there are a couple things that sales leaders can do, super specific. First, take nothing else away from this conversation. Insert the game-changing question into the cadence of regular work so that your people know whenever they come to you with a deal, your first question you're going to ask is, how will this customer be different? When your people come to you with a win, you're going to say, how is the customer different? You insert that, you shift the true north. Some other things that you can do, two other techniques you can use as a sales leader. And again, you don't have to wait for your VP of sales. You got five salespeople, you start doing this. So first one, ask the game-changing question. Second one, when you talk about your numbers, just translate into the number of people. We sold 25 units. Each one of those units goes into a company that will now have faster whatever. Just translate your numbers into what they mean. And you can do that on the reports you're regularly getting. And then the third thing is once a week, however often you have your regular meetings, tell a customer impact story. How your offering made a difference to a customer. And when you're telling it, whatever seller did that, say, this made such a difference to these people. And I hope you're really proud of that. And that's something we all want to do. Because I think you have to understand as a sales leader, the internal conversation becomes the external conversation, and you are the loudest voice in the ear of your seller. You're louder than the CEO. You're louder than your boss. Your voice in the ear of your seller is what drives performance. So when you tell your sellers, how is a customer different? Here's what these numbers mean. Here's how you made a difference. What you're doing is you're reframing the whole thing. Because once we get beyond food and shelter, human beings have two fundamental needs, belonging and significance. They want to be part of something bigger than themselves, and they want their work to matter. So what you're doing as a sales leader is you are connecting the dots for them and telling them your work makes a difference. And what we know, the numbers follow.
And just that, keeping those two things in mind, belonging and significance, that's the essence of what good sales coaching looks like. Helping people understand those two things.
Helping them understand that. And those three things I've given you, ask how will the customer be different, talk about your numbers in terms of number of people, make sure you're telling stories, not just about the great win, but how the sale made a difference to the customer. If you do those three things and you do them consistently for 60 days, you'll have a different sales team in 60 days. They will be performing at a higher level.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much. It's been really fun to have you back, and hopefully you'll come back for a third time sometime later.
It's always great to talk to you. You and I are on the same wavelength, what they're thinking before they talk.
For listeners, thank you for being with us today. You can find and follow Lisa Earl McLeod, and I strongly suggest that you do, on LinkedIn, as well as on Twitter or X at Lisa Earl McLeod. Be sure to check out her books, Selling with Noble Purpose and Leading with Noble Purpose. And Lisa's website is McLeodandmore.com. Thanks for listening. Please make sure that you leave us a rating or review. Recommend us to others. Of course, again, go back and listen to previous episodes, especially episode 31 from about a year and a half ago with Lisa. And we'll look forward to having you join us again next time. Thanks for being with us. Take care. Thank you for listening. And I really hope you've enjoyed this episode of Mental Selling. Please make sure that you're subscribed, and as always, leave us a comment or a rating. Share it with your networks. You'll get more content like this on our website at integritysolutions.com. Until next time, I'm Will Milano with Integrity Solutions. Thanks very much again for being with us.